Welcome
to the Faculty Podcast, brought to you by RTS Washington, part of a 50-plus year endeavor to train pastors and other church leaders in the ministry of the gospel in the United States and around the world. We have a smaller crew with us today, but a small crew, but a good crew. Myself, we've got Dr. Peter Lee in Old Testament, and we have Dr. Grace Sutanto in Systematic Theology. And arriving in the studio today with the TNT Clark Handbook of Neo-Calvinism, part of a 5-plus-year effort to collect the best scholarly research on Neo-Calvinism to date.
Lord willing.
I looked at the table of contents. I've read the table of contents, Gray.
That's the most important bit.
It's the most important bit, and it is stunning and stellar.
Yep.
And I'm excited about at least half the chapters.
I was not hired.
That's right.
I was not yet hired at RTS when I first started talking about the handbook with the publisher. So it's been a long time coming, indeed.
Well, we've got our regularly scheduled programming coming up, but give us the 5-minute speech. Give us the elevator speech on why we should buy this $170 book.
Well. Yes, so it is definitely appropriately priced by an academic publisher like Bloomsbury. So it is $170, but it is, 40 chapters and nearly 600 pages, which includes also an annotated summary, which is a guided tour of all the primary sources in Neo-Calvinism, annotated bibliography, I mean. And you've got great contributors in there. You've got Tim Keller writing on the chapter on pastoral ministry. You've got really stellar Dutch scholars working on Neo-Calvinism, writing on particular figures like Gijsbert van den Brink on G.C. Berkhouwer, Henk Vandenbelt, who writes on the sovereignty of God. You also have chapters that connect figures that I think we know about in the Reformed tradition, but we don't really connect them to the tradition of Neo-Calvinism, but they do belong in that tradition, like Gerhardus Voss. So a chapter on Gerhardus Voss and the ways in which he might also embody some of the principles of Neo-Calvinism as well. So you don't only have a tour of the theological distinctives of Neo-Calvinism. You have a tour through the primary figures of Neo-Calvinism from Bovink all the way to Voss to someone like G.C. Berkhouwer and Klaus Schilder, second, third generation figures. And then you also have a guided tour through the history of Neo-Calvinism from Neo-Calvinism in the Netherlands, Neo-Calvinism and medieval reformational sources, and also even Neo-Calvinism in world Christianity. So the last part of the handbook covers the legacy and trajectories of Neo-Calvinism, whether through philosophy, world Christianity, the hard topic of race, pastoral ministry, the arts, and even both analytic and continental philosophy. It's also covered Chris Watkin and Nick Wolterstorff writing in those fields as well, so appropriate representatives of that.
And there's a lot of social and academic buzz. I think it's going to be it's obviously already a valuable resource.
Yes.
A lot of people are looking to it as a hub, a nexus point for the contemporary discussion on these things. So.
Right. So one of the questions that I normally get after people have picked up the Neo-Calvinism introduction was, this is a great overview of Kuyper and Bovink, but we want to know what comes afterwards. Why is Neo-Calvinism in America so different from Neo-Calvinism in the Netherlands and best practice elsewhere around the world? What is this thing called reformational philosophy, Herman Dooyeweerd? What's that all about? So this is the book to follow up with if you've read Neo-Calvinism Introduction and you've had those questions. And I want to encourage you that there will be a paperback coming out. And the word on the street is that the paperback is going to be $40 instead of the daunting $170. And for the work of 40 authors through 5 years, I will still say that $170 is actually appropriately priced.
For an academic book.
Yes.
Right.
5 years, 40 authors, and it was a lot of back and forth and emails. Shout out to Stephanie DiMaria for helping us with that as well. And but $40 would be a bargain in a year or so. That's right.
The reason why $140 is an appropriate price is usually these go out to libraries at this stage. And so if you can encourage your local library or your seminary library to acquire, and then obviously in a year or so you'll get the paperback and ebook.
Yes, ebook is already available as well. So it's out there. I've seen people in the Philippines buy Kindle versions of it.
Right.
I can't imagine reading a 600-page book on a Kindle, but apparently it's possible.
Well, it does beat carrying around a fairly big, bulky book of any kind. But When are you going to come out with volume two?
There will probably not be a volume two. If anything, there might, you know, well, we'll see what happens. Who knows?
A sequel. Maybe it will be as good as Dune 2.
Yes. Well, we'll talk about Dune 2 some other time. You know my thoughts about that. I will also say a selling point of this is that it does fit nicely as a coffee book decorative table. Uh-huh. So
it
if you'd
is
like
beautiful.
Another.
It is a beautiful cover.
Yeah. It's just some good color.
You know, I think this is going to be a nice contribution to make some correctives of some false understandings of neo-Calvinism
that's
out there. That so a lot of the interactions oftentimes might be based on false understandings and applications as opposed to what it truly is representing. So this is a nice contribution to just make correctives. If you're going to disagree, let's disagree correctly with what it actually is espousing.
So you'll be able to trace some of those permutations of neo-Calvinism, but none of those permutations would involve theonomy or reconstruction.
Or things of that nature,
things of that nature, that's right. You might see some differences in like Hermann Dooyeweerd and, you know, the Dooyeweerdian stream of neo-Calvinism versus Bavinck, let's say, but definitely some interesting permutations are not going to be found in there.
So this is a little bit more of a superficial, I guess, question, but it is a beautiful book, and we'll put a link to the show notes so you can see listeners can see the cover art. I know you sent out an email like 3 years ago or 2 years ago.
Yes.
With, you know, asking for votes.
On the cover. Yes.
So what? Why'd you pick this one? Can you just, I mean, give us a little bit.
Yes. So the cover is a painting from a Dutch painter named Johan Thorn Prikker. And it was painted in 1911, I believe. So it was from the right era, from the right, you know, geographical, historical location, context. And it's the sower from Prikker. And, you know, just from looking at the cover, there are certain things that you can see in the image that I think resonates with the tradition of neo-Calvinism. The sense of vocation as a holy calling, and yet vocation is not a triumphalist endeavor. You know, you look at the sower there, and it's difficult work. He's laboring as a creature of the earth, but it's the same time as a creaturely person, and his profile seems to be made out of the earthly material around him. There's also a halo behind him, or perhaps it's the moon that resembles a halo right behind him, right? Which means that his work is a heavenly calling. And at the same time, you know, even though in the parable of the sower, the seeds that he's sowing is, of course, the gospel. It's the work of evangelism. It's still a very earthly sort of working, right? So it's a heavenly and earthly vocation thing going on there. And creatures of the dust working for heavenly purposes. I think that's very fitting for neo-Calvinism. And at the same time, a subversive sort of critique of triumphalist motifs that people might draw from neo-Calvinism. So we give a more thorough explanation in the editorial introduction, but that's the main reason.
Well, that's great. I'm excited about it. And Gray, congratulations. We are proud to count you as one of our own.
Congratulations,
Gray. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes, all the way back from 2018, 2019.
Our task, though, today... Do you like that transition?
I did. I appreciate it very much.
The Lord's Prayer. We are on Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. We are, in other words, at a crossroads in the Lord's Prayer because we move from the third, well, as I think of it, the third person imperatival section, the praying for God. It's interesting that the order is fairly straightforward. It's a two-part prayer, and in the first part, we're praying for God, and in the second part, we're praying for ourselves and our neighbors, and perhaps that reflects the Ten Commandments, you know, the two tables of the law, as it were, and the greatest commandment, to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. So we're moving now to that second portion, the imperatival section, where we're calling on God for our basic needs and for mercy and for our neighbor, and that and also that the evil one would not have the victory. So give us this day our daily bread. I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this. One of the things we conclude theologically is we're supposed to pray to God for our basic needs. And there's implications to that. There's theology behind that. There's an anthropology behind that. it's rather a profound thing to pray for our basic needs, and that's a humbling thing, and there's all sorts of things we could conclude from that. But one of the things that I was thinking about even on the car ride over is that Jesus doesn't say, pray for your basic needs. You need to pray for the basic fundamentals of life. He says, pray for your daily bread. He puts it in a metaphor. He puts it in an image, and he picks bread as kind of a synecdoche, as a representative mm-hmm. picture of what we as human beings need. For those who are on a keto diet, this might not be your basic fundamental need because it's high in carbs. But for those of us who love our carbs, bread is historically been a kind of symbol of just basic human needs and productivity. So how do we think, why does he put it that way, do you think?
Well, a few things, I think. The first thing that came to my mind was, what Luther says about this petition of the Lord's Supper, which is that you're confessing your trust and dependence upon the Creator for your basic things, so that, God is not just your Redeemer and therefore is a provider for entrance into supernatural realities, but rather even with respect to natural matters, you're dependent on God. And secondly, he says, this is about God's providence as well. When it says that God is giving us our daily bread, he asks us to consider, how do you get your daily bread? Well, you get it from the people who work with the fields, the people who actually knead the bread and actually bake the bread, and the people who deliver the bread to your homes. So you are presupposing, therefore, that God is providentially the one behind all of these very regular things in motion. And so implicitly, Luther is also arguing for a kind of sacred understanding of your vocation, I think, there. That when you are baking bread, you're doing God's will as well. You're serving God. You're, in the language of Westminster Confession of Faith, you're a secondary cause with God as the primary cause behind it all.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about the corporate aspect of that. I remember watching a video a number of years ago on is one of these YouTube, I think it was like an economics promotion video mm-hmm. or something like that. But, how all of the factors that went into giving you a pencil, mm-hmm. is this like 5-minute video of how a pencil gets made. And basically every country in the world is involved in the manufacture of this particular pencil. Mm-hmm. And the similar reflections, even if we think about an ancient culture where bread comes from, it's irreducibly corporate. You can't do it by yourself.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think, coming back to your comment about carb and how, actually research shows that like carb and carbiness is not good for you, and it's, sugar spikes and
I don't think I said that.
High in calorie.
Well, I am not on the keto diet.
Yeah, yes. And neither am I, for the record. But, I was thinking about there's this influencer online called Brian Johnson, and he's arguing for this philosophy of life where you should do everything you can to not die, which means, therefore, mm-hmm. abandoning, calorie-rich diets that have lower nutritional value. And he actually said in one of those videos that I saw recently that this is why he's not a Christian, because Jesus says, come to me and I'll give you bread and wine, which ages you. But come to Brian Johnson, and he'll give you nutritional food, which actually is good for you, right? So he spends all his life really just detecting all the things that he does and calculating them in such a way where he's going to slow down the rapidness of aging, and also actually say, even though 1 year of chronological time has passed, there was no passing of biological time with respect to his body because of all the things that he's doing, all the things that he's eating, his workouts and his sleep pattern is all being regulated, and he's spending millions of dollars basically investing in this and then showing people how to actually not age. So which was interesting to me that Jesus, as the one who is the second person of the Trinity, who knows all things, uses bread here. I don't think it's merely accommodation to what people think of as daily sustenance and need and very basic food. It's also, I think, a symbol of our finitude. Like, you got to embrace your finite. This food is gifted to you, but it is bread, and therefore it will perish, and you will perish alongside with it. So it's a confession of your dependence on the Creator, and therefore also an acceptance of your finitude, that you will die.
Yeah, and maybe we need to let Peter say stuff here, but yes. Just to...
You guys are just not letting me get a word in.
I'm sorry, Peter. But there's a big debate, actually, on the word daily.
Right.
In how to translate it here. It's an odd word. It does seem like Jesus's point there, regardless of exactly how we translate that, is like every day you have to pray this prayer, that there is a, put the accent on our finitude, that the prayer is worded, and it's not worded in such a way that, Lord, give me everything that I might need for the future now, but rather there's a dailiness of my dependence. I'm not to pray that my bank account is filled with all of the money that I will ever need. I'm not to fill my barn with everything that I might ever need, but that there is a dailiness to our dependency on God that is healthy and good and pious, even though it can be for us humans hard, because we have to know where our bread is buttered, where it's coming from.
Right. Mm-hmm. There is a prophetic understanding where I think it's in Hosea 2, where the prophet is praying essentially for his daily bread, but the way it begins is with God to allow for the rain that will provide the agricultural growth that will essentially work its way down. I don't think it was bread in particular, but just that basic idea that everything that we have, material goods, is provided by the Lord. It's really kind of a beautiful, almost like a prayer chain, in terms of the way that the Lord works to answer our prayers, and how one of the blessings that we have is the way that God will do these things and orchestrate things for our regular provisions, for just the material needs that we need from day to day. It is a good point, though, Gray. I mean, I've never really thought about the Lord's that give us this day our daily bread as a reminder of not just the Lord's provision, but even our finitude, the idea that we now need bread in a way that to sustain us, to remind us that we are still creatures, yes, there is a preservation of life here, but, you know, this is not the end product of our lives. And that the daily bread reminder is a reminder of our utter dependence on God from day to day. That's true. But also that there is a greater world yet to come, an eschatology in the daily bread. I think that's fantastic.
Right. I think that, you know, so Jesus cares not just for our ultimate end. So, you know, let your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We should prioritize the coming kingdom and will it to fruition and pray it to fruition, in a sense. But also not just that, Jesus also cares about our penultimate ends, namely the daily natural things that we take for granted, right? So I think, you know, Bhaving oftentimes emphasizes that there's always a conflict in the Christian life, and emphasizing either contemplation of the life to come and action in the life that is. And we're always one-sided. You know, we're always going to say, well, we got to care about life now, and therefore we neglect the things to come, and we neglect contemplation and prayer. And at the same time, because we are contemplating so much, oftentimes we neglect action and serving people that are right in front of us now, and actually taking care of our own now, paying the bills and so on. And I think there has to be a kind of holding together these two things that could be in tension because of our sin. And Jesus shows us the way. He causes us to pray for our daily bread alongside letting your kingdom come.
Mm-hmm. Peter, how much do you think is here of like echoes, you know, with the idea of bread as the chosen metaphor, echoes of the wilderness generation, echoes of like manna, the dailiness of it, the fact that it's bread, we've already got that corporate dimension there.
Yeah.
I think it is a standard image for our, you know, the table, as it were, but perhaps also some biblical imagery.
It's
there.
It's possible, a reminder that, in a sense, we are kind of in wilderness, and thus he uses bread imagery to remind us that we are not in the eternal kingdom, where it's more, you know, meat festival celebration, and thus this is more of a daily bread of what is provided from day to day, just what you need in anticipation. So there's almost a forward pushing here in the petition, that type of idea. Yeah, yeah. That's very intriguing. And this is part of the reason why I think studies in biblical imagery truthfully really needs to be done a little more thoroughly, is to bring out these type of things. The petition, he doesn't say, give us what we need from day to day. Mm-hmm. He says, give us our daily bread. And the fact that he uses a metaphor, an image of bread, can be something that speaks to an average, you know, Jewish Christian in their contemporary day. Because you're right, I think nothing represents regular daily sustenance than bread in an ancient context.
Yeah.
Even in the modern context, we kind of speak about, you know, providing food on our tables, you know, as just a regular daily sustenance.
Yeah, we use, it's a common, you know, I already used it, right? Where your bread is buttered. I mean, it's a basic fundamental metaphor for our provision.
And there may be a richer biblical theology behind the bread associated with the manna. Thus, we are in wilderness. So give us our daily bread, because that's what we need now, because we are in wilderness. Mm-hmm. As opposed, and help us to anticipate always more the greater homeland that is to come, yeah, where we won't have to make this petition any longer. We'll be at the wedding feast of the Lamb and so forth. What I've appreciated about the petition, I guess, is always a tendency towards idolatry with materialism, mm, and how we are asking for what we need from day to day, to keep that always in check, and how our tendency at times is to take a material good and then to idolize it as if this is exactly, if I don't have this, then everything in my life will fall apart. Mm. And how he is being very cautious here to give it as just what we need from day to day, so we can avoid any temptations towards lording certain things above the Lord himself as God in our lives.
So I shouldn't pray for a bicycle?
It's okay to pray for a bicycle, just don't worship the bicycle like your well-being is dependent on the bike. You know,
right,
he may not grant it to you, yeah, but God is still God.
Yeah.
It is an encouragement to consider the things that we need versus the things,
yeah,
that we want.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, another interesting aspect of this imperative that's sometimes remarked on is it is an imperative. There is a straightforwardness, and it can even feel almost disrespectful. We've made this point before with the Lord's Prayer, that it's brief to the point of almost, it's emphatically brief. You know, it's pointedly brief, I should say. Its brevity is kind of part of the point. And here, especially in the context of Matthew, Jesus says, don't let your prayers be like the Gentiles who, you know, will do these kind of manipulative prayers. And don't let your prayers be but like the self-righteous who will do these lengthy prayers. But rather, keep your prayers straightforward. And here, at this turning point in the Lord's Prayer, that is very much on the surface of the text. Give us bread is the kind of core sentence here. And it's a straight-up imperative. There's no manipulative language. Oh, Lord, may it be that in your wisdom and providence we might have the bread of today. You know, there's nothing like that. It's just a simple request, which I think, again, gets at the, you know, it says something about God, that the expectation is that God delights in giving to his children good gifts, that God does not need us to engage in this kind of flowery language or this overly manipulative process as the Greeks do with their gods, but rather is a straightforward and loving father.
It's very much like the petition of God as Father. I mean, a child doesn't come to us and begin, oh, Dad, the greatest father in the world, you know, who gave me life and has clothed me and sustained, mm-hmm, me every day of my life, give me $20. He just comes up and says, give me $20, but not in a, you know, in a way that appeals to our tendencies as fathers or as parents.
Yeah, yeah. We've already hallowed the name of God. It's not disrespectful.
Right.
We've already hallowed the name of God. We've prayed his kingdom come. but then there's a straightforwardness in the ask and the request.
And there's a, and there is a certain, I think, profundity to its simplicity, and in that context, that makes it very sweet and endearing.
Well, thank you, brothers. This has been a great discussion. And for those of you who are listening in, if you would like to know more about RTS, you'll find a link in the show notes, both to the website, to our campus website, but also to if you'd like to give to the mission of RTS, or if you would like to sign up for classes, there's ways to do all of that. And we'd welcome you to check those links out. You'll also see a link to Dr. Sutanto's book. Congratulations again, Greg. Glad to that it's finally out in the wild. Thank you all for joining us. We look forward to speaking with you, talking with you, hearing from you. And in the meantime, take care.
That you know, we have a large contingency of our community that are, you know, pretty darn well off.
Yeah, we don't need to
pray.
We're not worried
bread.
Where the bread is coming
right.
from tomorrow.
Right.
But there is a mindset in Deuteronomy that you know, the Lord's going to give you cities you didn't build, you know, vineyards you didn't grow, cisterns you didn't dig, but to not forget the Lord. Because if you do, then you're going to really think it was your hard work, your sacrifices that got you these things, where the implication is that, you know, when you go through suffering, you depend on God for obvious reasons. But it takes just as much faith to be God-centered when things are going well, because there's nothing to challenge it.
Yeah.
And so,
right. It encourages a posture of humility at every point.
And when you're struggling or suffering or in material need, it really, you instill that, it instills that humility and that Godwardness because you have nowhere else to go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when things are going well, you have to remind yourself, you really have to work to remind yourself that everything I have is really of God. It's true that I sacrificed years of my life to get my degree, to get this job, but it was the Lord who gave me the strength to do this.
Right.
And if we don't remember that, then we really will think that it was me, my hard work, my sacrifice that God, and God's not in the picture at all. So it is interesting how, you know, in Deuteronomy, to succeed without God is another form of covenant curse because you really think you earned this and God is not in the picture. So the petition to give us this day our daily bread as a not just material but a spiritual posturing to remind ourselves that God is God, I am not, He is creator, I am creature, is something that even the ones that the Lord has blessed with extraordinary wealth and riches, praise God. But there is still a need to petition, to pray this petition because of that tendency that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the prayer of thanksgiving is actually a corollary to this prayer. We pray, give us this day, but it's anticipation of praying that a similar prayer when the meal is served, as it were. That tradition of gathering and saying, thank you for this meal. This is from your hand. This too, you raised the sun this morning and you let it set in the evening. You brought this meal to the table. That reminder that especially in the ordinary things, God is the giver of the gifts.
Yeah. I mean, someone, again, who scrapped and clawed and looked for dimes and nickels to provide, you know, a loaf of bread for his family can really pray that. But someone who, you know, can has just an abundance of provisions in their pantry, should still be able to pray that, remembering where all of that came from.